Sorry to disturb your lunch, and welcome to the FCC. My name is Tara Joseph. I'm a journalist with Reuters and on the board of the club here. Thanks for coming out on what is a pleasant, sunny day in Hong Kong. But I think many of us can remember back to, I think it was a week ago, when you really couldn't see this far in front of you because the pollution was so bad. And that is a reminder of some of the major environmental issues that we face. We know they're happening every day, but sometimes it really does slap you in the face. So it's my pleasure today to introduce Lawrence Bram, a noted economist, author, and lawyer who has given over his life, really, to activism and environmentalism and working to make communities a better place throughout the world. Now, he's known as a senior advisor to the Ministry of Environmental Protection in the PRC. His latest book, Fusion Economics, is on sale over here. And he's the author and chief economist of the New Earth Institute. Interestingly, over lunch, I found out that he started off as a corporate lawyer, working with multinationals, and really made a very sharp turn in his life through seeing what was actually happening in the world. And the other interesting note before he comes to speak about what he believes is happening in China is I asked him, are you an optimist or a pessimist about the future? You didn't give me a totally straight answer, but you did say that it's the next generation that you really feel is going to make the difference, people who are in their 20s now. So it's my pleasure to invite Lawrence Bram to come and speak, and of course we'll have plenty of time for question and answer at the end. Mr. Bram.
Thank you, Tara, very much. That was a very nice introduction. It's really great to be back here at the FCC and to see so many old friends. I actually joined the FCC in the mid-80s. I think it was Derek Davies and Howard Coates of Far Eastern Economic Review who introduced me in here. So it brings back a lot of memories to be back in this room and to be back at the club. So thank you for having me. Some of you may be asking, now what's this Guailo doing advising the Ministry of Environment on environmental policy in China? And I spent much of my time in the 90s working on state-owned enterprise reform in China, and then much of the time from the decade from 2000 on doing social enterprise work on the Tibetan Plateau, which led me to see many of the environmental crises that China is now facing. I remember when I first started working on the Tibetan Plateau in 2002, the Brahmaputra River was this massive, rushing, powerful force that just, you know, looking at it, you were just blown away by the force of the water. And of course, all year round, there were glaciers. And by 2010, the Brahmaputra, as it flows near Lhasa at Gongar Airport, had become really just a creek. And there were Sahara-type dunes on both sides, and many of the glaciers had disappeared. This is a phenomena not only to China, across the Himalayas, the Arctic, it is happening at a very fast rate. So I started to do work with people like Li Wei, who was the former secretary to Zhu Rongji at the State Council Development Research Center, and others in Ministry of Finance, people around current finance minister Lo Jiwei. And, you know, we found that the European Union was also very interested in China's climate issues, because the European Union's 2020 goals are, you know, smart, sustainable, and inclusive. Inclusive meaning closing gaps between rich and poor. But there's another side to the agenda. Europe does have a lot of the technology that China needs in terms of insulation, solar, smart cities. But the problem is each of the European countries which has developed this technology has, in a way, too small a scale. And if it can be introduced into China, that scale can be increased and costs can drop enormously. Looking at joint ventures, at possibilities for collaboration with China that would then lead to the export of these systems and technologies globally. That's how I came to work as an advisor to the Ministry of Environmental Protection through a European Union dialogue frame agreement. And The first thing that kind of hit our desk was the question of how do you define ecological civilization? Because under the China Dream concept, Xi Jinping introduced ecological civilization, and the 18th CPC in 2012 November stated five principles of ecological civilization being political, economic, cultural, social, and ecological, which means only one of them has to do with the ecology. So this was the first assignment, and it came to our desk. How do you define ecological civilization? I'm going to turn to a graph here. Hilda, if you could just put that on for me. And this was really the framework that we came up with. And because one of the criteria was China needs its own solutions. It needs its own response to the environmental crisis. We know the pollution in Beijing, but it goes much deeper. It's not just pollution. It's not just the fact that when you wake up on a winter day in Beijing, you can't see 3 feet in front of you. It's also about the contamination of the water system. Some 60% of the underground water is undrinkable. Some 70% of surface water is too toxic for human contact. That goes into the agricultural systems. This is not a question of hugging trees or having blue skies. It's a question of food and water security. It's a question of basic health. But at the same time, how do you present these ideas to a government that likes to come up with its own ideas and doesn't really like outside advice? Has anyone seen the movie Inception? I'm sure you have. Inception was about a group of guys who got a leader, a business leader, to make a huge decision, changing the course of events, believing that it was his own decision. So rather than saying to the Chinese, hey, you should do this, you should do that, which is something they don't like for many reasons, because they're always having, you know, Washington saying do this, do that. The idea was to work on policy drafts that would have an osmosis effect and get into the system. If you repeat it enough and other people repeat it, it begins to be something they believe in. And so one of the criteria is we have to revive Chinese traditions and culture. That's also a problem because Taoism is viewed as superstition and Buddhism has become very complicated in China. And so what do you do with Chinese values? So we came to one thing we could bet on, and that was the five elements. You know, you have Jin Huo Tu Shui Mu, or gold, fire, earth, water, and wood. Now, believe it or not, these are actually Shivite in their origin from India. It is Vedic in its source, but it is considered to be something that everybody in the government in China doesn't have a problem with, because these are interactive elements that create and destroy each other. So to prevent destruction, we have to have sustainability, and we talk about the gold element, that being GDP. One of the biggest problems with China's environmental issues is the use of the GDP growth numbers to drive the economy and also as a measure for raising officials up. I mean, officials get promoted based on high GDP. Where did this come from? It goes back actually to 1998 when Zhu Rongji said that he would guarantee 8% growth but no more than 3% inflation and a stable currency. That was a very specific formula for that time, not for this time, to reemploy state-owned enterprise workers being laid off, being reemployed. It was not meant, and he never meant it to be followed blindly, as we have to have 8% this year, 9%, 10%. And so what happened under the period of Wen Jiabao was there was a constant, you know, excitement to have more growth this year than the year before, and a lot of it resulted in repetitive industrial and real estate investments, which have severely damaged China's environment. You can say that the $4 trillion stimulus package under those years has had devastating effects in the long term. And I say to the Chinese all the time, I say, I don't care, 8%, 7%, 6%. I don't think you have negative 2% growth. Okay, the investment bankers in the audience are getting really nervous now. Negative 2% growth, why? Because of the damage that's been done to agriculture, food, water, healthcare. I mean, the healthcare situations in most of rural China are sub-Saharan. And if even if you're in a major hospital in Beijing, you don't want to be there. The lines, the waiting, the conditions, the response. And so actually the cost is huge. Now, repairing this cost could be an opportunity for growth. And so one of the things we've talked about with the Chinese leadership is changing the matrix on GDP. And I talked a lot about Bhutan, gross national happiness. That's too esoteric. However, at Rio Plus 20, Helen Clark introduced at the table, we were in the room, over a dozen different matrices that have come out across the world, including the UNDP, Human Development Index. And the answer is, there are other matrices for measuring the health of an economy, and it's trying to get this idea to be incepted into the Chinese system. So we called it GDP plus, 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 plus environment, plus healthcare, and plus social well-being, which includes culture, many different factors, but trying to have a more healthy matrix. And I'm just going to, I wouldn't be so bold as to say that we've influenced the leadership, but just show you the process of inception. At the last National People's Congress, when Li Keqiang was being pushed on, is it 7.5% or 7%? He said, let's talk about elasticity of growth. That term was introduced, and you may see that coming up more often, together with Xi Jinping even saying ecological growth. So, I mean, at least they're working with this idea. The most positive sign was announced just last week in Zhejiang province, where the province said it will start to raise cadres not on the basis of GDP, but on the basis of air quality and on the basis of environmental protection and action in the community. And that will be the basis upon which they will be promoted. And again, in China, sometimes national policy begins locally. An experiment, of course, with national sanction. But if it works, it may become a national policy. Earth, infrastructure, the single biggest force that's going to change China is going to be infrastructure investment into renewables. Right now, 70% of China's total energy comes from coal. That has made China the largest producer of carbon gases, the biggest polluter in the world, coal. Two provinces depend on coal. Inner Mongolia and Shanxi, it becomes a political equation. How do you get them off of it? Well, of course, it will take steps. Methane, capture, different processes. But the most important thing we've encouraged is the investment of the new stimulus package that has been announced into not more roads, not more cement, not more of that stuff, but investing into the conversion of grids. China has with solar panels or thin film solar, using the high voltaic rays on the Tibetan Plateau. Scientists have told me from Xi'an, from Shanxi province west, can all be fueled by solar. But that's going to require major infrastructure investments into converting the grid. So we called the project the Great Green Grid. How to actually convert over through investment. An aspect of this has been the call by the leadership for the urbanization of the rural areas. To be very frank, this is an attempt to try and create a balance between those who have rural hukou or registration, which doesn't give them pension or health benefits, and those who have urban hukou. So they're going to urbanize everything. Now, the problem with that is you're going to dislocate the rural areas, and how do you urbanize everything without repeating the same disaster? So we've come up with something we call smart green and blue, and smart being efficient cities with public transport run on renewables. And frankly speaking, the cities are not efficient. I mean, people are stuck in traffic all day in Beijing with their Ferraris and their Lamborghinis, but they can't move anywhere. It is very inefficient to do anything in any major city in China. But the idea then is to promote efficient, smart transport, recycling systems for water, and to actually build the infrastructure fresh in the new urban areas that will allow to have a sustainable city, a smart city, a green city, and a blue city, blue meaning water systems. I was really pleased when I heard John Gaudi speaking at the UN this year, because he came up and with those three words. He said, we're going to have urban cities that are smart, green, and he said low carbon. So the blue didn't quite get in there, lost in translation. But at least the osmosis process is beginning. And so the most important aspect of this whole conundrum is water, the water element or finances, because nothing's going to happen unless the government is going to put in place the financial systems that are going to encourage business to adopt efficient energy, converting over systems. Of course, it's a one-time investment that may be high for a business, but if you have government subsidies or support, you can then shift over to lower cost, more efficient energy, which has a more lasting effect. And so this is involving green credits for real estate. Why should you be building real estate? Look at all those buildings in the major cities of China, all that glass, everything can be a solar panel. And this is where the European technology comes in. In Finland, they have buildings that create energy. They don't use energy. They're actually producing energy through solar. Even you go this morning, I was down in the fitness center here, you're on the bike. That can be producing energy. All of these things are a business opportunity. So the big question here is to get government and business away from thinking that environmentalists are restricting growth and restricting profitability. No, the scientists and the environmentalists are the innovators, the R&D centers for the next potential growth, mega growth trend in China and possibly globally. That brings us to the wood element or governance, because during my participation with Zhu Rongji's working groups during the 1990s on state-owned enterprise reform, I know too well the success lay in the coordination between different government ministries, which often do not work together and do not cooperate because of different interests. They have their own lobbying in China. And what he did was there were two core organizations. One, the State Commission for Reform of Economic Systems, which was a policy think tank that coordinated policy between all the different ministries, and an organization he established later called the State Economy and Trade Commission, which basically gave orders and said, this ministry, these ministries have, these industries merge, these ones have to do this, and basically coordinated overarching policy. So we say wood, architecture, the construction of government. The Ministry of Environment is a very weak ministry. The Water Resources Ministry is a very weak ministry. In the NDRC, or the National Development Reform Commission, they have all the power over the environment, but they're also the ministry that, or the commission that's in charge of the oil industry, all the fossil fuel industries. So in a way, there needs to be a restructuring of government, a merging together of the environmental, water, and planning functions, and in turn creating national level policy. There are people in the Central Bank Regulatory Commission who've said to me, we are keen on green finance. We see this as a huge opportunity, not only for business, but a great opportunity for the banking sector. However, we're not environmentalists. We don't understand. How do you regulate? What is the criteria for green lending? What's criteria for a green development? What, we don't know. We simply don't have those answers. And that's where the coordination function of government is going to be essential. And last is fire, or the spark of innovation, education throughout the system to train up new engineers and people who will be able to solve those problems, but more so business leadership who understand that we really need to have a more wholesome integrity in our business planning, and that business can be profitable and can be a driver for social change and protection of the environment. Moreover, with the power of China's propaganda system, if the political will is there to change minds and get people to think more about the protection of their environment, just simply how you use water and you don't waste water, a simple thing, it can go from top to down. They could be the drivers, but that depends on political will, and it depends on osmosis and the power of inception. Lastly, things I see that are happening good. They're talking about putting in 20 million electric power stations for electric cars, which they're now giving a $9,000 rebate. That is in contrast with an activist I work with in Hawaii, Hank Rogers, who drives the sole electric car in Hawaii to try and get the state to realize that it doesn't need to import $6 billion worth of petroleum a year to fund the state's electricity, because we have really bad schools in Hawaii. That's where I went to school. But we have all the resources of solar, wind, and tide, which can make that an entirely renewable and efficient energy system. It's an example. I come back to the 20 million electric filling stations for electric cars being put into China by 2020. If those are all fired on the coal grid, then it's useless. You've got to change the core infrastructure to make that work. Lastly, I want to just say before I open up to questions that the environment is the next opportunity for all business. It will be the next driver in the future. But I think that it's something that is not only up to business, it's also up to government, and government has to drive the policies. My own term with China's Ministry of Environment ended at the end of last year, and I'm actually on my way on Saturday to Nepal, where I'll be working with a group called ISIMAT. It's the Institute, International Center, I'm sorry, for Mountain Development. And we will be in Bhutan, with joined by the President of Iceland and the Arctic Circle Group, to work on the third pole policy planning for something called the Hindu Kush Himalaya Assessment. Now, running up to Paris and the end of the climate change talks, we are putting together the sort of penultimate study of the third pole, the Himalayas, which supports 40% of the world's population through the river systems that flow each year from the glaciers that are melting faster and faster each year. Ultimately, what we're putting together is the policy brief, something like this, to give to governments and to say, look, you guys, it's in your interest. It's in the interest of survival of your government to adopt policies that are going to drive business toward renewable and efficient energy. I use the example of China. When Wen Jiabao came to power, they were saying there are 80,000 incidents or riots a year. By the time he left, it was up to 150,000. Those are official Chinese government statistics. The increase is largely over environmental problems. People's water, local systems being contaminated, industrial waste, or health problems. And to correct the health, you've got to change the politics, you've got to change the economics, you've got to change the assumptions, and that means changing the viewpoint. That said, everybody else in this room here, it begins with us and the way we look at the environment and the way we live our lives, because we do have a choice and we actually can make demands on business to adopt the correct path. Lastly, I know everyone in this room works hard. They want to give their kids a good education. They want to give their kids a great future. But there's one thing, I'm sure most of you in this room can guarantee that, but there's one thing that we cannot guarantee. Can we give our kids water to drink? Thank you very much.
Thanks very much. We have plenty of time for Q&A and discussion. So if you'd like to raise your hand, give us your name and affiliation. We'll start over here and we'll sweep our way around the room.
Well, thanks very much. That was encouraging, I think, actually. I was a bit skeptical earlier. Anyway, your talk was, does China mean business on cleaning up the environment? We have one country, two systems. I'd be interested to know, I mean, you may not have followed Hong Kong, but what is the mainland doing that Hong Kong isn't and should do?
I think.
Sorry, my name's Andrew Wood, by the way. I'm a freelance journalist.
Thank you, Andrew. I'd say what China's doing, sort of the good things, is this process of inception continues, and it is. I mean, the government knows it has a problem, and the government knows that, you know, let's be frank, China's not going to do anything unless it's in the self-interest of the government to preserve its own political power. And 10, 15 years ago, if you talked about environment, it was not in their self-interest. The argument was, we need high GDP growth, we have to employ people, because if we don't do that, we're going to have social unrest. Now the answer is, you have high GDP growth and you have more social unrest, because that GDP growth is affecting the environment. So if the government is switching gears on this, and I frankly think it's got to take time. It will be a process, because what the top may decide wants to be done doesn't always sift into the levels fast enough, and you have, again, huge political interests. I'll just give you a quick example. Beijing. From human waste in Beijing alone, recycling that into energy. I've been told by the scientists that 20% of Beijing's energy needs will be totally dealt with. However, there's a big mafia that controls the waste process and collection of waste. So that's going to be, right now they can't even raise taxi fees for drivers so that they're willing to pick people up in Beijing because of the taxi mafia. So, I mean, it's a constant, fight between the government and what are effectively institutionalized triads. And in Hong Kong, what can we learn? We can learn that top-down coordinated policy to encourage business, financial policy to encourage, I don't know, is this club, do you have efficient light bulbs here? I guess you don't. You can be saving 80% of the electricity in this club and reducing your costs. It's a one-time investment. A little bit up front, you can bring it up with the board. I mean, this is the way of thinking that can begin in the process. Top-down has value. But then the problem is making it stick at the local level. That's the tough part in China. Might be easier in Hong Kong once the top makes that decision.
Hello there. My name is Kian Ng. Thank you very much for your very interesting talk. I guess I should ask the biggest question. How much is corruption an obstacle? And also, I think, from what I have seen, examples of countries that have done well in upholding or setting environmental standards tend to be like in Scandinavia, those countries where, it's a model for democracy, their people are empowered, whereas usually countries where it's very autocratic tend to not do so well.
Good question. I'm going to answer it with a true story. Corruption. Near the APEC Center, I have an ecotourism lodge. It was one of the very first eco lodges out by the Great Wall to try and preserve river water systems, the wall itself. And there's a number of bed and breakfast places that have emerged in the villages since we opened up around 2004. I think some people in this audience may have visited it at the Great Wall. And lo and behold, about a couple of months before the APEC meeting, the local environmental department in Huairo came to us. And we put in septic tanks. That was the first thing we did, is put septic tanks in. And about every quarter, we have trucks come and take waste out of the septic tanks. So the government came and they said, you see these septic tanks? They said, no good. We said, well, what do you want to do? We want you to put the waste in the river. We said, wait a minute. No, the septic tank is there, so the waste doesn't go in the river. You don't want that. They said, no, we want the waste in the river. It must go in the river. So what do you really want? Well, you need to buy a machine. That it's a machine, maybe it looks like this, maybe twice as high. That machine, all the waste goes into the machine, and it goes into the river. And the machine will clean it perfectly. I said, how much is the machine? It's 250,000 renminbi. And if you don't buy it by the end of the week, we shut you down. And everyone else is getting shut down if they don't buy it. And by the way, you only buy it from the authorized dealer who are going to give you the cell phone number of. And if you don't go to that authorized dealer, we're also going to shut you down. So my staff came to me and said, what do we do? I said, well, you take these guys out, do three things. Give them dinner, get them drunk, you know what else to do, I won't say that here, and then start to negotiate the price, which came down by about 100,000. So we spent about 130,000. We didn't get closed down, others did, others bought it. I figured they may have negotiated a better price than the Guaylo in the room, but okay. The result was we got the approval. We kept going. We had this machine. I'll tell you, just before I came here, because I knew I was doing the talk, I said to some of my staff, open up that darn machine. I want to see what's in it. I have a photograph of it. It's empty. There's nothing in there. It's just a tube. It's basically, we spent 130,000 renminbi, priced 250,000 renminbi, for something that might not even be worth 1,300 renminbi. I mean, it's a cabinet. It's a file cabinet. Like, you put your hang your clothes up on it or your jacket. That's my biggest concern. If you have decision at the top, you have great speeches, you have great ideas, even if you have the coordinating bodies, what happens at the bottom? That's what I'm concerned with. It was actually people in the government and state council who've said to me, 30 to 40% of the windmills in China are not even hooked up to the grid. They're just there for show. That's my fear. On that positive note.
Over here, please.
Thank you, Lawrence. I think, like many, I think it's very positive to hear that something is done in an integrated way. And my question would be, as an entrepreneur in Hong Kong, like many of us in the audience, we run across so many frustrations trying to do our bit. Is there a tip you can give to us how we can bundle our efforts and somehow put it on a pin board? Maybe we can use social media in a positive way. I'd love to be doing that, but I don't know how.
Okay, first thing, I'm going to have a premise. You know, as kind of an activist economist, I always get told that we're the alternative. We progressives are kind of out there. And what I found is we're not. We are the new mainstream. But people don't know that. I'm in the FCC, but I'll say the mainstream media doesn't give enough time to what's happening at the grassroots level because there's a lot of change. I just came back from a month in the US, and I am so discouraged by what's happening at the top, but I am so encouraged by what's happening at the bottom. I was a member of Occupy Wall Street. I was there in Zuccotti Park making a lot of noise until we got cleared out. But the post-Occupy world, our youth who are going back to their community and they're figuring out whether it's going to be to do organic agriculture on the roof or whether it's going to be to raise funds to convert over your lighting systems or how to save water, and they are the new innovators. And I'm sure that there's a lot of corporate innovation in this room that's taking place, even in an office, even in a small scope. That small scope is big because it's time to connect the dots. So actually, if you want to start connecting the dots and bring together people who are making a change, you'll find out that it's much, much bigger. And that can influence government because you can influence the media. And here we are in the FCC. Let's get the media to start to shift the focus from focusing on just the price of oil, which is hurting the environmentalists right now because it's dropping, and focusing only on high-tech stocks like Twitter and Facebook, which are great, but they're not developing technology for the environment, which is out there. People are doing that technology development. It exists. It is pragmatic. It can reduce costs, but it's not getting enough capital because the capital market's not focusing on it because there's too much attention being put on highly leveraged financial instruments like Facebook, like Twitter. It's like soybeans. At the end of the day, nobody cooks the beans. But actually, the innovation is out there. We need to bring the attention to it. And once that happens, I do believe that driven by nothing else in the next generation, which does have a much more holistic view of the future that they know they are not going to have unless they change things, that we're going to have a quantum shift. And if I'm back here 5 years talking, it'll be talking about all the opportunities and investments that are going on in renewable energy, water recycling, organic agriculture, no GMOs, all of those things are going to be happening. But it can begin in this room because all of you are connected in this business community and part of this organization, which can influence the global perception.
Over here.
Sorry, thank you very much for your talk. I may have misheard what you just said. You said if the price of oil is low, that hurts the environment.
No. I didn't say it hurts the environment. It hurts our push for environmental solutions and renewable energy because as the price is coming down, governments have less reason to adopt renewable energy. If the price is high, then of course it becomes efficient to move into solar, wind, other sources. All of those things become effective. But if you see a price crash in oil, then the resistance point will be, oh, look, you see, it's not efficient. Renewable energy is too expensive. These are all the arguments. Actually, I'm not a scientist, but I'm in rooms like this with scientists all the time, and the feedback I get from them is that renewable energy is not more expensive, but the upfront cost is more expensive. And of course, why Europe wants to cooperate with China and why I got involved in this is because they have the solutions, but the cost per unit are higher because the numbers are smaller. But if you took Finnish technology, you move it to China, I mean, you know, every time you increase the volume 100 times, you're lowering the cost by 20% on solar. And so that's just one example. And of course, if you have the numbers, China, later India, of course, and Africa, I mean, in the end, the cost of fossil fuels could be higher than, would be higher than all the renewables we can access.
Out on the veranda.
Hello, I'm Sally, a freelance journalist. My question is that you mentioned, like, can we guarantee the kids the water to drink? But as a matter of fact, a lot of like local high rank officials are immigrating to maybe in America or bringing their kids and family, sending them abroad. So I wonder how this idea incepted to the central government solve local problems, where as in locally, the real estate investment and industrial investment served as a major economic drive.
I'll just correct you. The government officials, the high-ranked officials, are being arrested, and it's the private business leaders who are running to America and inflating prices in Silicon Valley. And to be very frank, one reason why is food and water security. I mean, if you go to these sort of like Jenny Lu in Beijing, this is this kind of store that specializes in imported foods. They have grown one store after another. And who's there? It's not expatriates. There's not that many expatriates these days. It's all local, wealthy Chinese who are buying all of their foods as imports. And what's pushing China's huge investments into Africa and South America? Yes, the resources, the minerals that are part of the polluting industries, but actually the big investments are going into food, into plantations, because China's going to face a food security crisis. It's facing it right now, in addition to a water crisis. And yeah, I heard they banned a lot of golf courses in Beijing, but they built more. I mean, this is kind of a cycle that goes on. But it is absolutely critical for China to try, and on one hand, it's investing. The strategy is to invest in controlling food supplies overseas, Russian relations. Russia has fresh water from the Arctic. That's going to be a huge import of water from Russia. All of this is what's coming down the pipeline. And yes, a lot of rich Chinese are immigrating to areas where they have clean food and clean water because that's what they want for their kids. So it's a crisis. Unless China actually addresses the issue domestically, it won't only be a issue of political social instability, it will be a brain drain.
We have a question right here.
I'm Alexandra Tracy of Huiping Ventures. I just wondered where you are on the future of nuclear in China. One of the biggest IPOs we did in Hong Kong last year was CGN Power, so the investment community really likes it, but obviously the NGO community is a bit split.
I'm stuck on this one, and I'll tell you why. Because, you know, as a kind of activist, I have to kind of be with the NGOs and say nuclear is bad, we shouldn't have it. As a realist, I'll tell you China's going to roll it out in big numbers. And they will, because the energy needs there are huge. And the nuclear will address more issues in terms of providing clean energy faster than anything else within the shortest period of time. So if you asked me to choose between what is the worst of two evils, I'd say probably the first priority is zero carbon energy. That's what I always come back to. That has got to be our solution. And if nuclear is an initial way of addressing that, China will do that. It's on the planning. You know, it's already in process. It's not going to be reversed. It's going to happen. Question is, how do you regulate it? How do you make it safe? How do you administer it? These are another set of equations that need a lot of top-down and a lot of input. But they are going to roll out nuclear in a very big way. Right now, what they're trying to do to deal with the air pollution problems in Beijing is not sophisticated. They're shutting down factories temporarily for events like APEC. There was a Norwegian delegation in Beijing last week to look at the clean air problem, and it was a beautiful day. But I mean, the way they do it is they shut down factories and they reopen the factories. They're trying to push the factories out, you know, further away into Hebei province, but you're just pushing the problem out and the problem will come back to you because the wind blows and the next day you're hit with it. So it's none of those things are solutions. Ultimately, the solution will be on the infrastructure side. The biggest cause of carbon are not your cars. They are actually electricity. Plugging in our cell phones. I mean, it's the electricity. And yes, come back to your question, they will do nuclear. That's on the cards for certain. Not my recommendation, but they'll do it.
We're going to have running out of time, so we'll do two more quick questions, if you don't mind, right here and right here. And I think you'll be around afterwards at 2 o'clock for book signing and questions again. We'll start right here down the middle.
Genevieve Hilton from BASF. You mentioned that you see a lot of, you started out introducing European technologies, which if scaled up could become much more viable. What's the European technology that you would be most excited about, that you think this is the one that could really have a future, could really have a potential if it were really introduced at scale in China?
Well, there's three countries I look at, and in principle, three technologies. I think the Finns have developed the zero carbon building, and they perfected it. It creates energy. And I'm totally blown away by what they've done. And what they also have done on a miniature scale is something that China could adopt. They have an organization called TECAS. What TECAS does is it invests in R&D. It supports R&D companies, but the R&D is then shared within the Finnish community. And the idea is to make all the industries stronger. And I think this is where you have this kind of mix of, you know, activist environmentalism with top-down kind of, we could call it planning or coordination, but the government is saying we're going to support this because that R&D is valuable for all of us. And, you know, they've got the innovation. There's no question about it. Germany has done a great job in terms of sourcing the grid, conversion of the grid. And I think in some places in Germany you can choose. I mean, you can actually say we're going to use, you know, solar versus we're going to use geothermal. I mean, they have created even a kind of democracy of choice with what kind of renewable energy you're going to use. And the UK is probably leading everybody in terms of the financing mechanisms. Green bonds and all the different green financial instruments that will be, you know, the next trend for the capital market. And so I think in 5 years from now, I'll be sitting here and listening to somebody from JP Morgan or Goldman Sachs or talking about their next green, you know, bond, making that actually work in terms of creating those exact systems. And that's where we have a lot to learn.
We have a question here.
My name is Adrian Wong. I wondered, would you say that your next job would be even more difficult? Because in China, you have, obviously you have to face different departments, so they all have different interests, you have to deal with the top, you have to deal with the bottom. But I presume in your next job, you would have to persuade different countries to share water from the Himalayas. I mean, I know you haven't arrived at your new job yet, but can you give us a glimpse of, or you know, how would you want to start with that?
The new work I'm doing is actually derived from something that I was instrumental in articulating called the Himalayan Consensus. And if you Google Himalayan Consensus, you'll see a lot of stuff. Basically, it came from a combination of the work I did in environment in China and also social enterprise pioneering in the Himalayas, my own social enterprises on the Tibet Autonomous Region. However, social enterprise and the idea of community-empowered businesses or communities saying we don't want aid, we have to create businesses to protect our culture, to protect our environment. Very often the culture has in it all the tools, all the knowledge, and all the rules for protecting environment, particularly across the Himalayan region. And, you know, it's really taking those ideas and giving them power. Or giving them recognition. It's not an idea that's coming from a think tank in Washington or in Boston. It's something that is actually with local people. And so we launched our first Himalayan Consensus Inception meeting last November on the sidelines of the SAARC summit. And the purpose was, again, inception, to get the ideas into the SAARC leadership. SAARC is a South Asian regional cooperation group. And of course, they don't cooperate. SAARC has a lot of, you know, within its organization, there's a lot of lack of cooperation. But as, you know, Rajiv Gandhi once said, we are all connected because the river systems of South Asia don't flow like this. They flow like this. And ultimately, that precious resource of the Himalayan snows, the cycles that I came to understand very well living there, for many years, are cycles of, you know, that winter, the snow, it is very deep into the grass systems, it's very deep into preventing erosion, and then it forms the river systems which melt in the spring and give the nourishment across the region. If that system is broken, we have a crisis for 40% of the world's population. We will have food and water security issues. We are talking about war. It is really bad. And so the preventive mitigation will require cooperation. And again, I'm in the room with scientists who know their stuff. The scientists in South Asia are way ahead of the curve in terms of knowing what needs to be done, understanding it. The problem is converting that into policy and getting the government to push business into the direction of adopting those solutions. And that's why I say, part of what we're trying to also do in this new work is to convene people who don't like to sit together, government, business, finance, and civil society, and change, again, inception, change the perception, because it's the civil society, it's the grassroots who are the innovators, the R&D, the scientists are our R&D for what will be the next mega growth opportunity for business, and government will want to lead that or be deposed by it. So I think they all have a reason to be coming on board and taking it seriously. Hopefully with the rise of Modi and some of his thinking, this will begin to take some momentum. But no, it's not going to be an easy task.
Thank you. And I know there are many questions left in the room. So I'm going to do this. I'm going to break with FCC tradition as a mainstream journalist who learned a lot of things today. Many people need to go back to work at 2 o'clock. So if you do need to go and you'd like to leave, please do take the opportunity to do so now, and we'll take two more questions from the front of the room, but we will only go for another 5 minutes if that's okay, because we do need to get on with affairs at the club. So for those of you who need to go, thanks so much for coming, and we'll start right here and then we'll finish up here with a final question.
Jeremy Higgs, Environmental Investment. Thank you very much, Lawrence, for a very interesting presentation. I had two quick questions, actually, but I'm going to keep it to one.
Thank you. I've
just been brought into order. With all this concern on carbon emissions and everything, how important do you feel is this coming meeting in Paris in December this year, that a serious deal is made? How optimistic are you that it can be, and what part must China play in making that deal?
I'm actually not optimistic, and this is why I became involved working with China and now with South Asian governments. I was very active at the COP17 in Durban, and I found that most of the progress that the developing and underdeveloped countries are calling for is being stopped by three countries: Canada, the United States, and Saudi Arabia, because of the fossil fuel industry. So there's good talk, there's a lot of nice chatter from Obama, but actually what's being done is counter to that. And so what we did was we did a side event at the time with China, India, Brazil, basically the BRICS. And I realized that everybody's going to do their own thing, that they're going to take mitigation measures, they're going to move in the direction of renewables, not because there's an overarching agreement, but because it's in each country's own self-interest. And the sooner the technology becomes a good business opportunity is the sooner that those people see it in their interest to lower costs. And that's what's going to happen. And it was actually that meeting, because I got so fed up in the room, I'll tell you the truth, I went out the street, I joined the protesters. But I realized the protesters were useless because there are too many Darth Vader guys, and you can't have, you know, anything affecting the people in the room. But somebody said to me, hey, up at the KwaZulu University, there's the alternate COP taking place. Go there and listen. And I went to the room. I took a taxi there. And the African students had come up with a plan for creating 1 million climate change jobs now. That was the name of the blueprint. And these students, young students, had gone through the economics, the numbers, and they said, we're going to convert this industry from coal over to renewable. And they had each system, and they mapped out how many jobs would be created with each measure. And it was actually that inspired me to go back to China and start to work with. I'll be very frank, I started work with Zhu Yanlai, who is the daughter of Zhu Rongji, and Li Wei, who was his secretary, and started to draft up something that eventually the EU came in, and that's how we had this project. But I mean, it was actually the African youth who inspired that. And so coming full circle around, I don't think anything will be solved in Paris. There may be more publicity stunts like we saw at APEC. I see that only as a publicity stunt. But actually, I do believe generationally, two things will happen. Countries will do it on their own for their own self-interest to survive politically. And that will be in part driven by youth who want jobs and want to change the current situation for their future. And, you know, to quote the youth who protested at Rio+20 and surrounded the room, all in red, the red line, the state leaders are not coming out unless they cross this line. They protested against the UN document, the future we want, and said this is not the future we want. And I think that's where the change will come.
One last question. Well, we'll bring the microphone down this way. Right behind you. Yep.
First observation, I suspect that the Chinese leadership, that means the Chinese Communist Party, they are beginning to think and that for their own future sustainability, that they will have to move in the direction that you have been talking about. Secondly, I do hope that what you've been saying about the EU countries cooperating with China, I do hope that that will take place. And the second observation is that I do hope that after you finish your Himalayan job, keep your contacts with the environmental department and keep on pushing what you've been saying, because that will help the things to get things moving forward. Because if it is true that Obama had some of his environment people working, if that story is correct, working much early on before the APEC meeting with the environment people on the Chinese side, which led to Obama and Xi Jinping coming to an agreement on the environment, that means that you should be going to Paris and make sure that they come forward together so that Xi Jinping will get all the developing countries on his side and Obama keeps his promise, even though that he only has 2 more years to go.
Thank you, Hilton. I'll just say Hilton Chong Lien, former urban councillor in Hong Kong, has always been a big influence on me because he is somebody who always keeps a very rational view, because our world is very much divided between panda huggers and bashers, and I think you always have to keep China in the room and try to keep a kind of rational, cool mind, because he's always been very influential to me in our conversations on that. A couple of comments. One is, I know the media spun it that Obama's team pushed China into a climate deal. I don't think Xi Jinping thinks he was pushed into anything. I think that China has its own plan. I do believe the leadership absolutely understands the environmental questions are critical for their survival. I do believe that they are, certainly some of these ideas, I can't say all of them, but some of these ideas are finding osmosis, inception into the leadership. On the other hand, I think it's things like what's happening in Zhejiang province, where they're turning to local cadres and saying, you don't sort out air quality, you don't sort out the environment, you will not be promoted, that actually will start to reduce the kind of stuff like we faced, where we were buying, you know, effectively coat hanger cabinets for hundreds of thousands of renminbi. These things will start to move. I do feel that. I do also feel that it is critical to get Obama to stick to his promises, because we have not seen enough done on the environment in the United States. And you know, for the point of view of America's own self-interest, it has all the R&D, it has all the potential to actually be the world leader on this, but we're not putting the R&D into that. I'll be a little facetious and say we have 4 industries, Twitter, Facebook, Google, and Apple, and the only one that makes something you can touch is Apple, and all the money is going into this, but to be very frank, the innovation and the science is all there, but we're just not putting it to work, and that's really a shame.
Being hurt by the environment, and they will be pushing the CPC. And that is why when you go to Paris, I think you could be able to do your share, whatever it is.
Thank you, Hilton, for that vote of confidence. And I will say that the work that we're doing with ECMAD China is in the room, and it is a participant, because the Himalayas is a shared resource and a shared challenge and a shared opportunity. So thank you for sharing your time with me today. I greatly appreciate you being here and listening.
Thank you very much. You're around for a while, so there are books, there's some space for some more discussion, and I wish everyone a great afternoon. We do have a small gift from the FCC to thank you for coming, and I'll pass it along as well.